Morning, I took my 300-page manuscript and began to lay it down on the floor, section by section. I put a 2-page scene here, a 10-page passage there. I put these pages down in a path from beginning to end, like a horizontal line of dominoes or like a garden path made of tiles. There were sections up front that clearly belonged in the middle. There were scenes in the last 50 pages that would be wonderful near the beginning. There were scenes and moments scattered throughout that could be collected and rewritten to make a great introduction to the two main characters. I walked up and down the path, moving batches of paper around, paper clipping self-contained sections, and scribbling notes to myself on how to shape or tighten or expand each section in whatever necessary way. I noticed where things were missing, transitions, vital information we needed to know before what happened could make any sense. And then, on a blank piece of paper, I blocked in what I thought was needed and lay the page on the pile where it fit in. This page held some space, perhaps for whole scenes, in the way that, after a loss, a great friend holds some space for you in which to grieve or find your bearings. Scribbling notes on various sections to indicate that, in fact, something was at stake there, I went ahead and let bad things happen to these people whom I had been protecting. I found places where I could lean on them harder, push them, load them up in a way that would make their catastrophe inevitable. And I blocked the catastrophe in, too. Then, when I was sure, I stacked up all the pages in their new order and set about writing a third draft. I wrote that draft short assignment by short assignment, making each section, no matter how small or seemingly casual, as good as I could. I took out whole paragraphs that I loved, paragraphs I shoehorned into the book because I liked the writing or the image or the humor. I worked on it for 8 or 9 months, sending off the first third, which my editor was amazed by, and then the second section, which he loved. I finished the third section around the time I broke up with the man with whom I'd been involved for some time. I had a brainstorm. I would mail the third section off, borrow the money to fly to New York, and spend a week there, doing the line editing of the book with my editor, and, at the same time, getting away from this man I was breaking up with. Also, I could collect the last third of the advance that Viking owed me and do a little retail therapy in New York City. I wrote to my editor to say I was coming. He did not say not to. I told the man I was involved with to move all of his stuff out of my house. I borrowed $1,000 from my aunt, promising her that I would pay it back by the end of the month. And then I flew to New York. My first morning there, I put on my girl writer dress and heels and went to meet my editor. I figured we would start editing together that very morning, and then he could give me the last of the advance. It would turn out that I had bounced back from this devastating setback, and that truth and beauty had once again triumphed. Everyone would be so shocked to hear that this book had almost been thrown away. But my editor said, "I'm sorry." I looked at him quizzically. "I am so, so sorry," he said. "But it still doesn't work." He didn't understand why certain things happened the way they did, or why some things happened to begin with, and most importantly, why so little happened at all. I sat there staring at him as if his face were melting. "I am so sorry," he said. And for a while I was too stunned to cry. I kept touching my forehead, the way you pat your head, to make sure your hair is okay. I think I must have looked like Blanche DuBois on Bad Acid. Then I started to cry and told him I had to go right that very second. He said to phone in the next day. I said I would, although I did not actually expect to be alive then. Luckily, I was still drinking at the time. I went to the house where I was staying with old family friends, slammed down a dozen social drinks with them, and then took a cab to meet some other friends. I had a few hundred more drinks with them, and the merest bit of cocaine. Actually, I began to resemble an anteater at one point. Then I went to a liquor store and got a half pint of Irish whiskey and went back to the house where I was staying and had little social slugs of Bushmill straight from the bottle until I passed out. I was a little depressed when I woke up. I looked at my manuscript in my suitcase. Thought about all those beautiful, hilarious, poignant people I had been working with for almost 3 years, and all of a sudden I was in a rage. I called my editor at home. He was not planning on going to work that day. He was a little depressed, too. "I am coming over," I said. And there was a silence, and then he said very tentatively, "Okay," like he wanted to ask, "and will you be bringing your knives?" Then I went downstairs and caught a cab to his apartment. He let me in and tried to get me to sit down, but I was too crazy and disappointed and angry and crushed and humiliated and shocked. I held my manuscript to my chest like a baby. There were sections where friends who had read it had laughed out loud or had called me, crying. There was some incredibly funny material in there, some important things no one else was writing about. I was sure of it. Sort of. I began to stalk around his living room, like a trial lawyer making her case to the jury, explaining various aspects of the book, some of which, in my desire not to appear too obvious, I had forgotten to put down at all. I filled in lots of spaces, describing things that existed between the characters that I had assumed were clear. I was ranting, 28 years old, savagely hungover, feeling like I was about to die, but I told him who the people were and what the story was. I sketched in the underpinnings of their lives and thought out loud how I could solve the bigger problems of plot and theme, how I could simplify some things and deepen others. I was not thinking about what I was going to say. Words were just pouring out of me, and when I was done, he looked at me and said, "Thank you." We sat side by side on his couch for a while, in silence. Finally, he said, "Listen, I want you to write that book you just described to me. You haven't done it here. Go off somewhere and write me a treatment, a plot treatment. Tell me chapter by chapter what you just told me in the last half hour, and I will get you the last of the advance." And I did. I arranged to stay with some friends in Cambridge for a month, and there I sat down every day and wrote 500 to 1,000 words describing what was going on in each chapter. I discussed who the characters were turning out to be, where they'd been, what they were up to, and why. I quoted directly from the manuscript sometimes, using some of the best lines to instill confidence in both me and my editor. And I figured out, over and over, point A, where the chapter began, and point B, where it ended, and what needed to happen to get my people from A to B. And then how the B of the last chapter would lead organically into point A of the next chapter. The book moved along like the alphabet, like a vivid and continuous dream. The treatment was 40 pages long. I mailed it from Cambridge and flew home. It worked. My editor gave me the last of the advance, which I used to pay back my aunt and to buy time so I could write a final draft. This time I knew exactly what I was doing. I had a recipe. The book came out the following autumn and has been the most successful of my novels. Whenever I tell this story to my students, they want to see the actual manuscript of the plot treatment. When I bring it in, they pore over it like it is some kind of Rosetta Stone. It is typed on paper that has become crisp with age. There are annotations, smudges, and rings left by coffee and by red wine. And it strikes me as being a brave document, rather like the little engine who could on the morning after. How do you know when you're done? This is a question my students always ask. I don't quite know how to answer it. You just do. I think my students believe that when a published writer finishes something, she crosses the last T, pushes back from the desk, yawns, stretches, and smiles. I do not know anyone who has ever done this. Not even once. What happens instead is that you've gone over and over something so many times, and you've weeded and pruned and rewritten, and the person who reads your work for you has given you great suggestions that you've mostly taken, and then finally something inside you just says it's time to get on to the next thing. Of course, there will always be more you could do, but you have to remind yourself that perfectionism is the voice of the oppressor. There's an image I've heard people in recovery use, that getting all of one's addictions under control is a little like putting an octopus to bed. I think this perfectly describes the process of solving various problems in your final draft. You get a bunch of the octopus's arms neatly tucked under the covers. That is, you've come up with a plot, resolved the conflict between the two main characters, gotten the tone down pat, but two arms are still flailing around. Maybe the dialogue in the first half and the second half don't match, or there is that one character who still seems one-dimensional. But you finally get those arms under the sheets, too, and are about to turn off the lights when another long, sucking arm breaks free. This will probably happen while you are sitting at your desk, kneading your face, feeling burned out and rubberized. Then, even though all the sucking discs on that one tentacle are puckering open and closed and the slit-shaped pupils of the octopus are looking derisively at you, as if it might suck you to death just because it's bored, and even though you know that your manuscript is not perfect and you'd hoped for so much more, but if you also know that there is simply no more steam in the pressure cooker and that it's the very best you can do for now, well, I think this means that you're done. Part 2. The Writing Frame of Mind. Looking around. Writing is about learning to pay attention and to communicate what is going on. Now, if you ask me, what's going on is that we're all up to here in it, and probably the most important thing is that we not yell at one another. Otherwise, we'd all just be barking away like Pekingese. Ah! Stuck in the shit, and it's your fault. You did this. Writing involves seeing people suffer, and, as Robert Stone once put it, finding some meaning therein. But you can't do that if you're not respectful. If you look at people and just see sloppy clothes or rich clothes, you're going to get them wrong. The writer is a person who is standing apart, like the cheese and the farmer in the dell, standing there alone but deciding to take a few notes. You're outside, but you can see things up close through your binoculars. Your job is to present clearly your viewpoint, your line of vision. Your job is to see people as they really are. And to do this, you have to know who you are, in the most compassionate possible sense. Then you can recognize others. It's simple in concept, but not that easy to do. My Uncle Ben wrote me a letter 20 years ago in which he said, "Sometimes you run into someone, regardless of age or sex, whom you know absolutely to be an independently operating part of the whole that goes on all the time inside yourself. And the eye motes go click, and you hear the tribal tones of voice resonate, and there it is. You recognize them." That is what I'm talking about. You want your readers' eye motes to go click with recognition as they begin to understand one of your characters. But you probably won't be able to present a character that recognizable if you do not first have self-compassion. It is relatively easy to look tenderly and with recognition at a child, especially your own child, and especially when he is being cute or funny, even if he is hurting your feelings. And it's relatively easy to look tenderly at, say, a chipmunk, and even to see it with some clarity, to see that real life is right there at your feet, or at least right there in that low branch, to recognize this living, breathing animal with his own agenda, to hear its sharp, high-pitched chirps and yet not get all caught up in its cuteness. I don't want to sound too Cosmicorama here, but in those moments, you see that you and the chipmunk are alike, are part of a whole. I think we would see this more often if we didn't have our conscious minds. The conscious mind seems to block that feeling of oneness so we can function efficiently, maneuver in the world a little bit better, get our taxes done on time. But it's even possible to have this feeling when you see, really see, a police officer. When you look right at him and you see that he's a living, breathing person who, like everyone else, is suffering like a son of a bitch, and you don't see him with the transparency over him of all the images of violence and chaos and danger that cops represent, you accept him as an equal. Obviously, it's harder, by far, to look at yourself with this same sense of compassionate detachment. Practice helps. As with exercise, you may be sore the first few days, but then you will get a little bit better at it every day. I am learning slowly to bring my crazy pinball machine mind back to this place of friendly detachment toward myself, so I can look out at the world and see all those other things with respect. Try looking at your mind as a wayward puppy that you're trying to paper train. You don't dropkick a puppy into the neighbor's yard every time it piddles on the floor. You just keep bringing it back to the newspaper. So I keep trying gently to bring my mind back to what is really there to be seen. Maybe to be seen and noted with a kind of reverence. Because if I don't learn to do this, I think I'll keep getting things wrong. I honestly think in order to be a writer, you have to learn to be reverent. If not, why are you writing? Why are you here? Let's think of reverence as awe, as presence in and openness to the world. The alternative is that we stultify, we shut down. Think of those times when you've read prose or poetry that is presented in such a way that you have a fleeting sense of being startled by beauty or insight, by a glimpse into someone's soul. All of a sudden, everything seems to fit together, or at least have some meaning for a moment. This is our goal as writers, I think. To help others have this sense of, please forgive me, wonder. Of seeing things anew. Things that can catch us off guard, that break in on our small, bordered worlds. When this happens, everything feels more spacious. Try walking around with a child who's going, wow, wow, look at that dirty dog. Look at that burned-down house. Look at that red sky. And the child points, and you look, and you see, and you start going, wow, look at that huge, crazy hedge. Look at that teeny little baby. Look at the scary, dark cloud. I think this is how we are supposed to be in the world, present and in awe. Taped to the wall above my desk is a wonderful poem by the Persian mystic Rumi. God's joy moves from unmarked box to unmarked box, from cell to cell, as rainwater down into flowerbed, as roses up from ground. Now it looks like a plate of rice and fish, now a cliff covered with vines, now a horse being saddled. It hides within these, till one day it cracks them open. There is ecstasy in paying attention. You can get into a kind of Wordsworthian openness to the world, where you see in everything the essence of holiness, a sign that God is implicit in all of creation. Or maybe you are not predisposed to see the world sacramentally, to see everything as an outward and visible sign of inward, invisible grace. This does not mean that you are worthless Philistine scum. Anyone who wants to can be surprised by the beauty or pain of the natural world, of the human mind and heart, and can try to capture just that, the details, the nuance, what is. If you start to look around, you will start to see. When what we see catches us off guard, and when we write it as realistically and openly as possible, it offers hope. You look around and say, wow, there's that same mockingbird. There's that woman in the red hat again. The woman in the red hat is about hope, because she's in it up to her neck, too. Yet every day she puts on that crazy red hat and walks to town. One of these images might show up dimly in the lower right quadrant of the imaginary Polaroid you took. You didn't even know at first that it was part of the landscape. And here it turns out to evoke something so deep in you that you can't put your finger on it. Here is one sentence by Gary Snyder. Ripples on the surface of the water were silver salmon passing under, different from the ripples caused by breezes. Those words, less than 20 of them, make ripples clear and bright, distinct again. I have a tape of a Tibetan nun singing a mantra of compassion over and over for an hour, 8 words over and over. And every line feels different, feels cared about, and experienced as she's singing. You never once have the sense that she's glancing down at her watch thinking, Jesus Christ, it's only been 15 minutes. 45 minutes later, she is still singing each line distinctly, word by word, until the last word is sung. Mostly things are not that way, that simple and pure, with so much focus given to each syllable of life as life sings itself. But that kind of attention is the prize. To be engrossed by something outside ourselves is a powerful antidote for the rational mind, the mind that so frequently has its head up its own ass, seeing things in such a narrow and darkly narcissistic way that it presents a colorectal theology, offering hope to no one. The moral point of view. If you find that you start a number of stories or pieces that you don't ever bother finishing, that you lose interest or faith in them along the way, it may be that there is nothing at their center about which you care passionately. You need to put yourself at their center. You and what you believe to be true or right. The core ethical concepts in which you most passionately believe are the language in which you are writing. These concepts probably feel like givens, like things no one ever had to make up, that have been true through all cultures and for all time. Telling these truths is your job. You have nothing else to tell us. But needless to say, you can't tell them in a sentence or a paragraph. The truth doesn't come out in bumper stickers. There may be a flickering moment of insight in a one-liner, in a soundbite, but everyday meat and potato truth is beyond our ability to capture in a few words. Your whole piece is the truth, not just one shining, epigrammatic moment in it. There will need to be some kind of unfolding in order to contain it, and there will need to be layers. We're dealing with the ineffable here. We're out there somewhere between the known and the unknown, trying to reel in both for a closer look. This is why it may take a whole book. I'm not suggesting that you want to be an author who tells a story in order to teach a moral or deliver a message. If you have a message, as Samuel Goldwyn said, send a telegram. But we feel morally certain of some things, sure that we're right, even while we know how often we've been wrong, and we need to communicate these things. For instance, I used to think that paired opposites were a given, that love was the opposite of hate, right, the opposite of wrong. But now I think we sometimes buy into these concepts because it is so much easier to embrace absolutes than to suffer reality. I don't think anything is the opposite of love. Reality is unforgivingly complex. When you start off writing, if you're anything like me, you may want to fill the page with witticisms and shimmering insights so that the world will see how uniquely smart and sensitive you are. Over the course of time, as you get the knack of doing some writing every day, what seems to happen almost organically is that you end up wanting your characters to act out the drama of humankind. Much of this drama does not involve witticisms and shimmer. Yet, this drama is best couched in moral terms. The purpose of most great writing seems to be to reveal in an ethical light who we are. My favorite moment in Jean Moreau's latest movie, a comedy called The Summer House, takes place in a kitchen when she proclaims that every human has something to cry about. When mocked by the owner of the kitchen and pressed to say what it is that we have to cry about, she tosses back her head of flaming red hair and says, "The winds of solitude roaring at the edge of infinity." How do we, as individuals and communities, behave with that wind blowing behind us? Are we well behaved, striving for dignity and compassion? Or is it every man for himself? As we live, we begin to discover what helps in life and what hurts, and our characters act this out dramatically. This is moral material. The word moral has such bad associations with fundamentalism, stiff-necked preachers, priggishness. We have to get past that. If your deepest beliefs drive your writing, they will not only keep your work from being contrived, but will help you discover what drives your characters. You may find some really good people beneath the packaging and posing. People whom we, your readers, will like, whose company we will rejoice in. We like certain characters because they are good or decent. They internalize some decency in the world that makes them able to take a risk or make a sacrifice for someone else. They let us see that there is, in fact, some sort of moral compass still at work here, and that we, too, could travel by this compass if we so choose. In good fiction, we have one eye on the hero, or the good guys, and a fascinated eye on the bad guys, who may be a lot more interesting. The plot leads all of these people, and us, into dark woods where we find, against all odds, a woman or a man with the compass, and it still points true north. That's the miracle, and it's astonishing. This shaft of light, sometimes only a glimmer, both defines and thwarts the darkness. Think of a medieval morality play as the model. We love to hear that goodness will triumph over evil, that the fragile prize, humanity, life, will be saved. In formula fiction, evil wins out until the very end. And then, against all odds, goodness prevails, and the hero gets to kiss the girl with the big bosoms. Life is somewhat more complicated than it was in the Middle Ages, but in many ways it is so much the same. Violent, terrifying, full of chaos and plague, murderers and thieves. So the acknowledgement that in the midst of ourselves, there is still a good part that hasn't been corrupted and destroyed, that we can tap into and reclaim, is most reassuring. When a more or less ordinary character, someone who is both kind and self-serving, somehow finds that place within where he or she is still capable of courage and goodness, we get to see something true that we long for. This is what helps us connect with your characters and with your book. This is what makes it a book we will foist on our friends, a book we will remember, that will accompany us through life. But you have to believe in your position, or nothing will be driving your work. If you don't believe in what you're saying, there's no point in your saying it. You might as well call it a day and go bowling. However, if you do care deeply about something, if, for instance, you are a conservative in the great sense of the word, if you are someone who is trying to conserve the landscape and the natural world, then this belief will keep you going as you struggle to get your work done. To be a good writer, you not only have to write a great deal, but you have to care. You do not have to have a complicated moral philosophy, but a writer always tries, I think, to be a part of the solution, to understand a little about life and to pass this on. Even someone as grim and unsentimental as Samuel Beckett, with his lunatics and garbage cans or up to their necks in sand, whose lives consist of pawing through the contents of their purses, stopping to marvel at each item, gives us great insight into what is true, into what helps. He gets it right, that we're born astride the grave, and that this planet can feel as cold and uninhabitable as the moon. And he knows how to make it funny. He smiles an oblique and private smile at us, the most delicious smile of all, and this changes how we look at life. A few small things seem suddenly clear, things to which we can cling, and this makes us feel like part of the solution. But perhaps we have the same problem with the word solution as we do with the word moral. It sounds so fixative, and maybe we have gone beyond fixing. Maybe all we can do is to make our remaining time here full of gentleness and good humor. Or look at the 14th Dalai Lama, who is, for my money, the sanest person currently on earth. He says simply, "My true religion is kindness." That is a great moral position. Practicing kindness, keeping one's heart open in the presence of suffering. Unfortunately, it does not make great literature. You will need to embroider it a little. Otherwise, you will have a one-sentence book. And potential agents will look at you as if, as the Texans say, you are perhaps not the brightest porch light on the block. So, a moral position is not a message. A moral position is a passionate caring inside you. We're all in danger now, and have a new everything to face, and there is no point gathering an audience and demanding its attention unless you have something to say that is important and constructive. My friend Carpenter says we no longer need Chicken Little to tell us the sky is falling because it already has. The issue now is how to take care of one another. Some of us are interested in any light you might be able to shed on this, and we will pay a great deal extra if you can make us laugh about it. For some of us, good books and beautiful writing are the ultimate solace, even more comforting than exquisite food. So, write about the things that are most important to you. Love and death and sex and survival are important to most of us. Some of us are also interested in God and ecology. Maybe what you care most passionately about are fasting and high colonics. Cappuccino enemas, say. This is fine, but we do not want you to write about them. We will secretly believe that you are simply spiritualizing your hysteria. There are millions of people already doing this at churches and New Age festivals across the land. Write instead about freedom. Freedom's worth fighting for. Human rights begin with and extend to your characters, no matter how horrible they are. You have to respect the qualities that make them who they are. A moral position is not a slogan or wishful thinking. It doesn't come from outside or above. It begins inside the heart of a character and grows from there. Tell the truth and write about freedom and fight for it, however you can, and you will be richly rewarded. As Molly Ivins put it, freedom fighters don't always win, but they are always right. Broccoli. There's an old Mel Brooks routine on the flip side of the 2,000-year-old man, where the psychiatrist tells his patient, listen to your broccoli, and your broccoli will tell you how to eat it. And when I first tell my students this, they look at me as if things have clearly begun to deteriorate. But it is as important a concept in writing as it is in real life. It means, of course, that when you don't know what to do, when you don't know whether your character would do this or that, you get quiet and try to hear that still small voice inside. It will tell you what to do. The problem is that so many of us lost access to our broccoli when we were children. When we listened to our intuition when we were small, and then told the grown-ups what we believed to be true, we were often corrected, ridiculed, or punished. God forbid you should have your own opinions or perceptions. Better to have head lice. If you asked innocently, why is Mom in the bathroom crying? You might be told, Mom isn't crying, Mom has allergies. Or if you said, why didn't Dad come home last night? You might be told brightly, Dad did come home last night, but then he left again very early. And you nodded, even though you knew that these were lies, because it was important to stay on the adult's good side. There was no one else to take care of you, and if you questioned them too adamantly, you'd probably get sent to your room without dinner, or they'd drive a stake through your ankles and leave you on the hillside above the mobile station. So you may have gotten into the habit of doubting the voice that was telling you quite clearly what was really going on. It is essential that you get it back. You need your broccoli in order to write well. Otherwise, you're going to sit down in the morning and have only your rational mind to guide you. Then, if you're having a bad day, you're going to crash and burn within half an hour. You'll give up and maybe even get up, which is worse because a lot of us know that if we just sit there long enough, in whatever shape, we may end up being surprised. Let's say it's only 9:15. Now, if you were to stick it out, the image or situation might come to you that would wedge the door open for a character, after which you would only have to get out of the way. Because then the character could come forward and speak and might say something important. It might even be the thing that is most important to him or her, and your plot might suddenly fall into place. You might see how to take that person from good to bad, and then back, or whatever. But instead, you quit for the day, and you feel defeated and shaken and hopeless, and tomorrow is going to be even harder to face because today you've given up only 15 minutes after you sat down to work. Remember the scene in Cat Ballou, where a very drunk Lee Marvin goes from unconscious to ranting to triumphant to roaring to weeping defeat and then finally passes out? One of the men watching him says, with real awe, I never seen a man get through a day so fast. Don't let this be you. You get your confidence and intuition back by trusting yourself, by being militantly on your own side. You need to trust yourself, especially on a first draft, where amid the anxiety and self-doubt, there should be a real sense of your imagination and your memories walking and wool gathering, tramping the hills, romping all over the place. Trust them. Don't look at your feet to see if you're doing it right. Just dance. You get your intuition back when you make space for it, when you stop the chattering of the rational mind. The rational mind doesn't nourish you. You assume that it gives you the truth because the rational mind is the golden calf that this culture worships, but this is not true. Rationality squeezes out much that is rich and juicy and fascinating. Sometimes intuition needs coaxing because intuition is a little shy. But if you try not to crowd it, intuition often wafts up from the soul or subconscious and then becomes a tiny, fitful little flame. It will be blown out by too much compulsion and manic attention, but will burn quietly when watched with gentle concentration. So Try to calm down, get quiet, breathe, and listen. Squint at the screen in your head. And if you look, you will see what you're searching for. The details of the story, its direction. Maybe not right this minute, but eventually. If you stop trying to control your mind so much, you'll have intuitive hunches about what this or that character is all about. It is hard to stop controlling, but you can do it. If your character suddenly pulls a half-eaten carrot out of her pocket, let her. Later, you can ask yourself if this rings true. Train yourself to hear that small inner voice. Most people's intuitions are drowned out by folk sayings. We have a moment of real feeling or insight, and then we come up with a folk saying that captures the insight in a kind of wash. The intuition may be real and ripe, fresh with possibilities, but the folk saying is guaranteed to be a cliché, stale and self-contained. Take the attitude that what you're thinking and feeling is valuable stuff, and then be naive enough to get it all down on paper. But be careful. If your intuition says that your story sucks, make sure it really is your intuition and not your mother. I see this character in a purple sharkskin suit, you suddenly think. And then the voice of the worried mother says, no, no, put him in something respectable. But if you listen to the worried mother, pretty soon you'll be asleep, and so will your reader. Your intuition will make it a much wilder and more natural ride. It may show you what would really jump out from behind those trees over there. You won't always get a clear, panting, aha, purple sharkskin suit. More often, you will hear a subterranean murmur. It may sound like one of the many separate voices that make up the sounds of a creek. Or it may come in code, oblique and sneaky, creeping in from around the corner. If you shine too much light on it, it may draw back and fade away. I think a major step in learning to rely on your intuition is to find a usable metaphor for it. Broccoli is so ridiculous that it works for me. A friend says that his intuition is his animal. My animal thinks this, he says, or my animal hates that. But whatever you come up with needs to suggest a voice that you are not trying to control. If you're lost in the forest, let the horse find the way home. You have to stop directing, because you will only get in the way. Writing is about hypnotizing yourself into believing in yourself, getting some work done, then unhypnotizing yourself and going over the material coldly. There will be many mistakes, many things to take out, and others that need to be added. You just aren't always going to make the right decision. My friend Terry says that when you need to make a decision, in your work or otherwise, and you don't know what to do, just do one thing or the other, because the worst that can happen is that you will have made a terrible mistake. So, let the plot go left in this one place instead of right, or let your character decide to go back to her loathsome, passive-aggressive husband. Maybe it was the right thing, maybe not. If not, go back and try something else. Some of us tend to think that what we do and say and decide and write are cosmically important things, but they're not. If you don't know which way to go, keep it simple. Listen to your broccoli. Maybe it will know what to do. Then if you've worked in good faith for a couple of hours but cannot hear it today, have some lunch. Radio station KFKD. I need to bring up radio station KFKD, or K-Fucked, here. It is perhaps the single greatest obstacle to listening to your broccoli that exists for writers. Then I promise I'll never mention it again. If you're not careful, station KFKD will play in your head 24 hours a day, nonstop, in stereo. Out of the right speaker, in your inner ear will come the endless stream of self-aggrandizement, the recitation of one's specialness, of how much more open and gifted and brilliant and knowing and misunderstood and humble one is. Out of the left speaker will be the rap songs of self-loathing. The lists of all the things one doesn't do well, of all the mistakes one has made today and over an entire lifetime, the doubt, the assertion that everything that one touches turns to shit, that one doesn't do relationships well, that one is in every way a fraud, incapable of selfless love, that one has no talent or insight, and on and on and on. You might as well have heavy metal music piped in through headphones while you're trying to get your work done. You have to get things quiet in your head, so you can hear your characters and let them guide your story. The best way to get quiet, other than the combination of extensive therapy, Prozac, and a lobotomy, is first to notice that the station is on. KFKD is on every single morning when I sit down at my desk. So I sit for a moment and then say a small prayer. Please help me get out of the way so I can write what wants to be written. Sometimes ritual quiets the racket. Try it. Any number of things may work for you. An altar, for instance, or votive candles, sage smudges, small animal sacrifices, especially now that the Supreme Court has legalized them. I cut out the headline the day this news came out and taped it above the kitty's water dish. Rituals are a good signal to your unconscious that it is time to kick in. You might also consider trying to breathe. This is not something that I remember to do very often, and I do not normally like to hang around people who talk about slow conscious breathing. I start to worry that a nice long discussion of aromatherapy is right around the corner, but these slow conscious breathers are onto something, because if you try to follow your breath for a while, it will ground you in relative silence. So, you sit down to work at 9 in the morning and do the prayer or the small animal sacrifice or whatever, and then breathe for a moment and try to focus on where your characters are, only to discover that your mind has begun to wander just a little. Typically, you may find yourself wondering how some really awful writer you know is doing and why he is doing so much better than you and what it will be like to be on David Letterman's show and whether he will mock you or laugh at all your jokes and let you be his new best friend, and what you should eat for lunch, and what it would feel like for your hair to be on fire, or for someone like a critic or something to stick a sharp object into your eye. Not to worry. Gently bring your mind back to your work. Let's say your character is sitting with his grown son beneath a cypress tree on a lion-colored hillside, chewing over in the sourest possible voice the few ecstatic moments of his life. And all you're going to do this morning is to squint along with him and listen, and possibly find out what some of those moments might have been. After a minute, you begin to see your man in someone's grassy backyard, not long ago, playing ping pong with a younger man, a hippie. And they are not competing, just hitting together, and you begin to capture this on paper. And after two sentences, you begin to worry about your complete financial collapse, what it will be like to live in a car. And then your mother calls, joyfully, to tell you that something fantastic just happened to someone who was mean to you in the eighth grade. You get off the phone, and your mind has become a frog brain that scientists have saturated with caffeine. You may need another minute to bring it back to the man's moment in that grassy backyard. Close your eyes. Breathe. Begin again. I'm sorry, I wish that there were a sharper, slicker way to do this, but this seems to be the only solution. Believe me, I hate natural solutions. Or at any rate, they're the last ones I turn to. 2 nights ago, I showed up to teach my class with a raw chest and a raging sore throat, the kind that feels like cancer of the trachea. I happen to have 2 doctors in this class, and one of them tried to assure me that it probably wasn't tracheal cancer, that in fact the viral cloud of mid-autumn had descended and many people were having similar symptoms. The other doctor recommended drinking really, really hot water. Hot water? I said, hot water? I should be home hooked up to an epidural, drinking codeine cough syrup, and you're prescribing hot water? Then I threatened to lower his grade. Of course, this is not a graded workshop, so my students tend to roll their eyes when I threaten them. At the break, that doctor brought me a cup of boiling water, as though for tea but without the tea bag, and I drank it. My throat and chest stopped aching about 20 seconds later. I hate that. Still, breathing calmly can help you get into a position where the workings of your character's hearts and the things people say on the streets of your story can be heard above the sound of KFKD. When you are in that position, you will know. I am struggling very hard not to use the word harmony here. So let me tell you a quick story. Last summer, I got a call from a producer in New York who wanted me to fly east 2 days later, stay in town overnight, do her TV talk show, and fly home. I thought long and hard about whether I should, for about 30 seconds. Of course I wanted to go, but I would have to make arrangements for Sam to stay overnight with his grandparents, and I needed to catch a return flight that would get me back in time to teach my workshop the next night, and the only one that could do that involved a layover at Dallas-Fort Worth. A layover at Dallas-Fort Worth is something for which, believe me, I am not remotely well enough. So I shared all this with the producer and took off for a committee meeting I had at church. I was a mess. Out of the right speaker, KFKD was playing a dress rehearsal of the TV talk show and of subsequent appearances with Dave and Arsenio. Out of the left speaker was a call-in program on airplane crashes with descriptions of what happens to the body on impact. I got to church and my committee had not yet assembled, but four of the church's elders, all women, three African Americans and one white, were having a prayer meeting. They were praying for homeless children. "Can we discuss my personal problems for a moment?" I asked. They nodded, and I told them all about my airline fears and how many moving parts there were to this trip east. They nodded again. They seemed to believe that between Jesus and a travel agent, things could probably be worked out. I sighed. My meeting was starting in another room, so I trudged off. My mind spun with images of the talk show, the airplane crash, and the madman with the Uzi at Dallas-Fort Worth. I was having a little trouble concentrating. The meeting ended, and on my way out, a little book on prayer caught my eye. I picked it up and stuck it in my purse, figuring I could look at it over dinner and then return it the next Sunday. All the way to the hamburger joint, I worried that I would be involved in a car accident and the book would be found on me. My survivors would know I had finally snapped, that I had become one of those fundamentalists who think the world is going to end tomorrow right after lunch. I made it to the restaurant, though, and when I sat down, I took out the little book. I opened it before I got it out of my purse so the cover wouldn't show, as if it were the rankest sort of pornography, like Big Beautiful Butts or something. I started to read, and within a page came upon this beautiful passage. "The Gulf Stream will flow through a straw, provided the straw is aligned to the Gulf Stream, and not at cross purposes with it." To make a long story short, I flew to New York, and everything went fine. I didn't have to stop in Dallas-Fort Worth, and I got home in time to teach my class. So now I always tell my students about the Gulf Stream and what it means for us, for writers, is that we need to align ourselves with the river of the story, the river of the unconscious, of memory and sensibility, of our characters' lives, which can then pour through us, the straw. When KFKD is playing, we are at cross purposes with the river. So we need to sit there and breathe, calm ourselves down, push back our sleeves, and begin again. Jealousy. Of all the voices you'll hear on KFKD, the most difficult to subdue may be that of jealousy. Jealousy is such a direct attack on whatever measure of confidence you've been able to muster. But if you continue to write, you're probably going to have to deal with it, because some wonderful, dazzling successes are going to happen for some of the most awful, angry, undeserving writers you know. People who are, in other words, not you. This is going to happen because the public herd mentality is not swayed by the magic that happens when mind and heart and muse and hand and paper work together. Rather, it is guided by talk shows and movie producers and TV commercials. Still, you'd probably like the caribou herd to run in your direction for a while. Most of us secretly want this. But maybe the herd is going to stuff itself on lichen and then waddle after some really undeserving riders instead. Those riders will get the place on the bestseller list. The movie sales, the huge advances, and the nice big glossy pictures in the national magazines where the photo editors have airbrushed out the excessively long eye teeth, the wrinkles, and the horns. The writer you most admire in the world will give them rave reviews in the Times or blurbs for the paperback edition. They will buy houses, big houses, or second houses that are actually as nice or nicer than the first ones. And you are going to want to throw yourself down the back stairs, especially if the person is a friend. You're going to feel awful beyond words. You're going to have a number of days in a row where you hate everyone and don't believe in anything. If you do know the author whose turn it is, he or she will inevitably say that it will be your turn next, which is what the bride always says to you at each successive wedding, while you grow older and more decayed. It can wreak just the tiniest bit of havoc with your self-esteem to find that you're hoping for small bad things to happen to this friend, for, say, her head to blow up. Or for him to wake up one morning with a pain in his prostate. Because I don't care how rich and successful someone is, if you wake up having to call your doctor and ask for a finger massage, it's going to be a long day. You get all caught up in such fantasies because you feel, once again, like the kid outside the candy store window. And you believe that this friend whom you now hate, has all the candy. You believe that success is bringing this friend inordinate joy and serenity and security, and that her days are easier. She's going to live to be 120. He's never going to die. The people who are going to die are the good people, like you. But this is not true. Money won't guarantee these writers much of anything, except that now they have a much more expensive set of problems. The pressure on their lives has actually intensified. Good, fine, you think. I'm into intensity. Those are the problems I want. But do you really? Yes, I really do. But some of the loneliest, most miserable, neurotic, despicable people we know have been the most successful in the world. Right, but it would be different for me. I would not fall for my own press clippings. I would not mention my achievements all the time. I would not say things like, "Boy, you think it's raining hard today?" I remember one day, I think it was the year I got the Guggenheim. It really rained hard. You'd never do that, unlike other people you could mention. That's very nice. It's all going to happen to somebody else anyway. Bank on it. Jealousy is one of the occupational hazards of being a writer, and the most degrading. And I, who have been the Leona Helmsley of jealousy, have come to believe that the only things that help ease or transform it are A, getting older, B, talking about it until the fever breaks, and C, using it as material. Also, someone somewhere along the line is going to be able to make you start laughing about it, and then you will be on your way home. I went through a very bad bout of jealousy last year, when someone with whom I am, or rather was, friendly, did extremely well. It felt like every few days she'd have more good news about how well her book was doing, until it seemed that she was going to be set for life. Threw me for a loop. I'm a better writer than she is. A lot of my writer friends do very well, hugely well, and I'm not jealous of them. I do not know why that is, but it's true. But when it happened for her, I would sit listening to her discuss her latest successes over the phone, praying that I could get off the line before I started barking. I was literally oozing unhappiness like a sump. My deepest belief is that to live as if we're dying can set us free. Dying people teach you to pay attention and to forgive and not to sweat the small things. So every time this friend called, I tried to will myself into forgiving both of us. I had been around someone from the South that summer.